A lot of people who are hearing this will have never heard the term gift economy. What is a gift economy?
Well, in our experience, it's a social context. In our case, Black Rock City in the Black Rock Desert, where our event is held, in which first, commerce is permitted. You cannot exchange goods for money. And building on that positively, we encourage the giving of gifts. You should come prepared to give. Those gifts might take any form. It might be an action on your part. It might be an interaction with someone. It might be anything that involves you in some way bringing forth some significant part of yourself and just giving it to somebody.
So give me some examples of if I was out at Burning Man, what would I see? Or even what kind of gifting have you done, gifts have you given and received out there?
Well, oddly enough, I don't give that many gifts. When I do, though, I put a lot of effort into it. Perhaps that's why I don't give as many as I might. I think it's the duty of the giver of gifts to not only to contemplate the nature of the person that they are giving the gift to. It's supposed to be a soul match, ideally. And you see a lot of art. Well, first of all, the event is the arena for the largest interactive art exhibition in the world, I think. And the artworks are unsigned, though we've never told anyone not to sign them. And I think that's kind of in the spirit of giving a gift. It's this sort of immediacy. It's from me to you. So it creates a social fabric that's just made out of art everywhere you go. It could take any form. It could be sculpture. It could be performance. It could be anything at all. At the same time, we have volunteerism rates. People who volunteer to help us form a civic infrastructure that are phenomenal and not normal in any civic environment. And those are gifts. And they're not given with an expectation of any specific return. And it is the nature of a gift, if you think about it for a moment, to have an unconditional value. You know, in that you don't, if you're practicing good form in these matters, if you expect a return, it's not a gift. And everyone knows how that feels when someone proffers something as a gift and then it's clear that it's meant to gain them something. And the gifts stale as soon as you qualified in that way. And we've related it to what we call radical self-expression, and that's the idea that everyone who comes as a citizen has some kind of duty, if they just open themselves to the idea, to give of themselves and to express what is radically situated within them, something that makes them feel real and that is unique to them. And then project that outward into a social world beyond their friends and beyond their acquaintances to strangers whom they know not. And this creates a kind of social atmosphere, a feeling shared by, I would say, most of the people who come, and that's thousands of people, an experience of this tremendous unconditional abundance that surrounds them. And it opens their hearts. And a gift well given opens a heart. And it requires an open heart to give it. You know, goods pass from hand to hand, but gifts pass primarily from heart to heart. And it's proved contagious. And it generates a spirit that for many, by their own testimony, is life-transforming.
I think some of the more obvious ways people first realize this out there is the little things they're given, actual items. So maybe you can describe the difference between bartering and gifting, and that might be... what's the difference between bartering and gifting?
Well, a gift is just like any kind of monetary transaction. That is, there's an exchange of equal value. You know, it even that you have something, they have something you want, you have something they want. if you were haggling in a marketplace, then you'd go back and forth until you reached the median point where you both determined that you'd be sufficiently satisfied, and you would get something back of equal value. When you go to the store and buy something, it's very literally apparent. You're forking out money and you're getting a product. Giving gifts does not involve that. It is done without an expectation of a return. The ironic result, however, is when you reach a critical mass in a society, and we've regard our event as something of a social laboratory, as gifts circulate through a community, a kind of decentralized cohesiveness begins to emerge, and everyone begins to feel as if they belong to everybody else. And I like to say that in that regard, I don't want to scare anyone off with metaphysics, but gifts are bearers of being. And it makes everyone feel supported in their being by the world they live in, which is something that in our world is can't be purchased. Like, you can't purchase that. You can't really purchase that. That the normal economic expectation would undermine the very process that would give you that result.
So how did gifting become a part of the whole Burning Man ethic and really the identity that you're trying to push for the whole event?
Well, as these things usually arise in cultures, it was spontaneous and really quite organic. We went out originally with just a small band and of people, and probably not more than 40, 60 people, and people more or less all knew one another. And everyone went there prepared to survive in this howling wilderness, which is the Black Rock Desert, subject to dust storms and with no resources at all. And the nearest town, a little mite of a thing without a grocery store. So we came prepared, everyone came prepared to survive in challenging circumstances. So there wasn't much margin for any kind of normal economic activity. And if you went camping with your family, you know, I mean, it wouldn't even be appropriate. If your grandmother, you know, came to the picnic and wanted an olive, you wouldn't sell it to her. And so it wasn't an issue. In the early days, there were bands who would come, and they would follow the model they were familiar with. So they'd set up bars and say, it's for the band, you know, because they normally made their money in bars that sold liquor. And it didn't work, of course, because everybody, in addition to bringing water and foodstuffs and camping gear, everybody bought an abundance of liquor. They're afraid they might run out of, you know, booze. So they all went broke. I mean, they gained nothing from it. They lost money. And, well, they maybe probably drank the liquor themselves eventually. And I hope it worked out for them. But so that didn't take root. And then one year, someone we didn't know who came only to sell goods and had never been to the event, which is okay, we welcome strangers, but he set himself up. We didn't even have a city perimeter, but he set himself up away from the center so he could discreetly do business, and he vended fireworks to people. And it was such a discordant note, you know. I mean, it was as if someone came to the family picnic and said, "Granny, you want some potato salad? You know, that'll be $2.99. And then in response to that and some other things, we began to realize, especially in 1997, that what we had here was worth preserving. And that however dim our first inkling was, that it had a spiritual value. It certainly created a spirit. And so we just outlawed commerce. And then from there, began to look at it and realizing, well, what made this spirit that we so valued? And that, what emerged from that was the realization that it was the passage of gifts that was opening people's hearts, that was bonding people together, that had a way of civilizing a space, because more and more people who we didn't know began piling in. But if you get a gift from a stranger, you're immediately bonded to them. In fact, oftentimes gifts from strangers will move you more than from people who really, who you think might be obliged to you in some way. So it actually becomes almost a pure proposition. And that often antagonizes, right? You're going, oh, a stranger did something for you. Do you realize what I do for you every day? I'm working my fingers to the, but, you know, what you're responding to is the absolute, the sense of immediate spiritual contact with someone from a quarter where you least expected it, where you had no reason to feel that you deserved it. It would feel as if they gave the gift to your spirit itself, you know, to something very intimate in you. And so it had a social utility, but it wasn't invented for that. It was done because it felt right. It was the way, at least for 8 days of the year, it was the way we lived. And so many cultural values are that way. Traditional societies, you ask people, why do you do this? And they say, because it's what human beings do. And I suppose we discovered a little more of our humanity and wanted to conserve that.
And so it sounds like what you're saying is when you stop giving things as gifts is kind of where you draw the line between your family or your community. You're saying, okay, you're an outsider, because with my family, I would never sell something. With grandma, I would never sell something. So it creates that division. And on the other side of that coin is that you can create a larger family or community simply by giving those, by making it a gift transaction instead of selling or bartering.
Yeah, it's not even a transaction, in as much as if I give something to you and it's a real gift, I'm not waiting for the other action that comes back to me. I'm just, you know, fitly speaking, my satisfaction is simply the passage of it through me to you. And if that's not its own reward, then you shouldn't have given a gift or called it a gift in the first place. And everyone knows that. Everybody, children know that. So, I mean, if you look at it from the other side, the reason this has become so valued is because we live in a world in which there is so little gift-giving. In fact, if you want, one of the hallmarks of community is gift-giving. People do that in real communities and in families. They give things. They're dysfunctional families. They're miserable communities. But still, that's the type of thing that announces the presence of that kind of contact between people. And we live in a world where you can lead your life independently of all others with your credit card. You don't have to interact with anybody, as a matter of fact. You really don't have to interact with a merchant. You're spared the chit-chat at the counter. It's an automated process. And today, in the industrialized world, in America, I think in particular, as community has become more of a piety and less of a reality, you see less gift-giving occur. You see less gift-giving occur, and what you see is more and more people stranded at the center of this, very isolated from one another, very isolated from one another, as isolated as people in a traffic jam on the freeway. And that's depressing. It depresses Americans, and when they get depressed, they tend to think, well, maybe if I go out and buy something, I won't feel so empty.
I think you started talking about this a little bit. You kind of, I shouldn't say proselytize, but you like to think with the grants you're giving and other, you're taking Burning Man off the ply. You've been doing that for several years, trying to promote the art and the ethics to become part of our society. Do you feel that the gift economy in particular, have you seen it manifesting itself outside of that 1 week in the desert?
Yes, and I think it'd be more accurate to say that Burning Man is taking itself off the pile. We cultivate our little garden, but the growth is actually beyond our control. I'll give you an example. The year of Katrina, it happened while we were at the event in the desert, and the news just rolled across the playa, and people were stunned. Joan Baez was there and sang Amazing Grace, and it was all in that response, that spirit shared with, you know, 40 or 50,000 other people. It was very moving. But it went further than that. There was a group of people who built a, two groups. So we have a DPW, Department of Public Works, that built the city. And there was a group, the temple crew, that built a large, elaborate temple that's devoted to people who have passed on. And it's their gift to the community. When it was over, not only did people start, we set up a donation station in our camp in the center of the city, and people gave at a pretty generous clip. But these people got together, and they thought, well, we've got equipment. We know how to survive in a wasteland. Why don't we go south? They ended up initially in Biloxi, Mississippi, and came upon a Buddhist community in Biloxi, of all things, and who had just completed the day before the hurricane struck their community's Buddhist temple. And, of course, the storm blew it away, as things are blown away in the Black Rock Desert. And so they set to work, and they knew the value of diesel, of water. They understand how to give a gift and how to interact with a community. And they'd been taught to by their experience, and they began a relief effort. They began demolishing houses. They began rebuilding houses. And pretty soon they were an entrepot for all these relief goods that nobody else out there was organized enough to accept and distribute. And ultimately, and this is my favorite part, the locals who saw that there were really no strings attached to this, a lot of the groups that went down were from were religious groups. Here was a group that really didn't have any agenda, it seemed, except to give something to them and help them. And they never went on for weeks. New people from the Burning Man community would replace others who had worked there. And finally, at the end of each day, this created a new institution, Burners Without Borders, which survives and which we help now. But it formed itself. And at the end of each day, they would assemble all of this whole debris that was the remnant of their old lives. These people lost everything in many cases. And would do what they do in the desert. Again, it was an extension of a culture. They started making art out of it and throwing it on a bonfire every night. And then pretty soon the locals started making art out of... You might say that in some sense that was perhaps the most stirring gift of all. It enabled them to here they were surrounded by just the ruin of their lives. And they would pick through that and put things together in some form that was expressive or beautiful to them, and then they would join with these strangers who'd come to give them a gift, and they toss it on the fire. Now, FEMA isn't going to supply you with that kind of opportunity. And it's gone on to do work throughout the world. There are many other instances of that. There's an organization called Black Rock Solar, which was a natural, that was sort of in-house, but it was a natural spinoff of our theme that year. In the desert, and the theme was the Green Man. We were looking at environmental concerns, and out of that, Black Rock Solar developed. They still have offices in ours, and they're the biggest player in the solar scene in Nevada right now, putting up solar arrays, hospitals and schools, and all over the state. And it's a nonprofit, but again, it's the nonprofits, theoretically at least, are there to give gifts. So it was an easy transition into that kind of organization, and they're thriving. In neither case did we say we want to propagandize and proselytize and extend, you know, our belief systems. People merely incorporated a way of being, and then not content with the experience at Burning Man, wanted to keep being that way. So it's led to this efflorescence of activities. And those are only two things that have come out of Burning Man. There's many, many other kinds of gift-giving milieu that have originated and continue to flow out of the event we created.
So a lot of what you described could just be seen as volunteering. Is volunteering basically the same thing, or is
it's a little more than that. I mean,
I also question, is volunteering the institutionalization of gifting? You know, if you said, you know, nonprofits, yeah, they're giving, but it becomes a job, and all that.
Well, you know, we have a lot of volunteers in our city, and I think you can if you, when you institutionalize that, you know, when it passes from being an ethos and then becomes a more externally organized activity, that you could lose the soulfulness of the thing and therefore the potency of it. Its contagious property, its power in the world. We go a little bit beyond saying do good, be altruistic. I don't even believe in altruism, frankly. I mean, there are a certain number of people who will always be altruistic, and they're always a minority, it seems. The idea of finding something that's utterly necessary within you, that it's rather like the motive of an artist, that has to be shared with the world. You know, that has to find a place outside of yourself that, that will affect, in such a way, will affect others. That's why our notion of giving has a lot to do with reaching very deep inside yourself rather than saying, well, I want to do good, so I'll sit in the phone bank. Not to say that someone couldn't, sitting on a phone bank might express their childhood wish and, you know, but, you know, if the motive that leads to gift-giving is uniquely drawn from the being, indeed the soul of each giver, then that's what takes it beyond the scope of mere organized idealism. You give the gift, why? For a greater access of being, to just be more, to be in contact with more, and to make your world more real. Not necessarily to make the world better, so much as to make it real. So that soulful part, you know, good gifts too often have a spontaneous quality. That is, people are inspired to give the gift. To the degree that you organize it, I suppose, I don't want to speak ill of, you know, of philanthropic efforts, but to the degree you organize it and just assign roles and slots to people, and you can lose that inspiration that carries the uniqueness of the individual and thus makes the gift potentially life-changing for the recipient.
So people aren't giving because it makes them feel good. You're saying it's because of an expression or because of...
Well, they're giving me because it makes them feel good. You know, I mean, it's my opinion that the greatest human need is to be real. I mean, oftentimes we mistake being real with hot sex or with, you know, some desideratum, you know, some appetite that we have. But I've found that I don't think our appetites make us real, particularly in that way. So they do it because it reveals their heart, they discover their own soul in doing so. And if you want to call that a selfish gain, I suppose it is, but it only works if you do it without thought to satisfying your appetites or your needs or something you want from someone. The value of it comes from you and is perfected in your relationship with the other.
Have you had incidents besides the one you talked about with the fireworks where you've had to enforce the no commercial vending or no selling exchange of money? And also, I guess the no barter rule is kind of more loosely enforced.
We don't have a barter police, if that's what you mean. We're generally in favor of liberty and freedom, but it's self-enforcing. There's no apparatus for doing that. It's just that having formulated and expressed what different people think that means in a convincing way, if someone at Burning Man set up a stand to sell things, they'd be shamed and shunned, as in any culture, when you violate some fundamental value. And it would just look tacky, you know? It would just seem wrong. We really don't have, we have rangers and there are people there who help to keep public order, but that's not a problem they have. There have been two or three instances, I think, in all this time. And now there, I'm sure, you know, there's a black market going on. People are, you know, and that's fine. We care about, and I don't want to ferret that out. That would be, you know, would create an awful social atmosphere. But in the public sphere, and what's available to everyone, and all these interactions in the city, it's the selling. No, it doesn't happen, and it won't happen, and we don't lift a finger, really, to make it that way. That means that people have incorporated that into their identity, and then you know you've got culture. until people do that, you don't have, you know, you don't have it. We try to create social situations that generate culture, because we don't think there's enough of that in the world. We don't think there's enough of communal experience. We don't think that our world in the West was much saturated with such things. And anything that many things to do with religion often involved unconditional value and a kind of giving that was not part of the commercial world. And at one time in the West, in medieval times, the ritual calendar was, you know, a third of the year, a half. And in non-industrialized countries, there's still a great deal, not only of barter, but of ritual giving that goes on. And that helps bond society.
So I know you've addressed this before, but building on your last answer, the coffee shop, the ice, and I guess the tickets too. People say, well, he just said there's no selling. And they go there and there's a coffee shop and they're selling ice. And also you have to pay to get in. So how do you square that with what you just said?
Well, I'll tell you something. If in a society you don't have conflicts about values that don't lead to discourse about apparent contradictions, then what you probably got is an ideology rather than a value system, because it's the nature of values to contend with one another. And I think it actually leads to philosophy and a keener understanding of what is valued. The ice we do, that's a really, that serves a public health function. There's no refrigeration unless you bought a refrigerator, and people could get sick, in fact. So we furnish that, and we could add it to the ticket price and just give it to people, but it seemed a little more rational to sell them the bags because we can't afford, you know, unless we raise our ticket prices. So we gave them ice. Sold them ice. We sell ice. And the cafe is the one. We have a cafe in the city, and it's this huge, it's this, as large as the Roman Colosseum, huge tensometric structure, quite beautiful. And coffee is sold there, not food, really. They may have some biscotti, I don't know. That's it. It's really a limited, you're talking about a very limited menu. It's mainly coffee, and I think cocoa. And comforting, two comforting things. And originally that was a theme camp. That was the Café Temps Perdu, the Café of Lost Time. And it was just given away. And that made perfect sense. And there are still many camps to do this. And you're free to go there and set up a camp and give away coffee. We will not harass you because you're competing with our, you know, with our product. But as things got much larger, again, the cost of doing that became, well, at a certain point, we couldn't do it. It would cost too much. But there was another value involved. In terms of running a business, in terms of, you know, providing product and being able to pay for it, and, you know, so you could do that, the original purpose, an equal value, was just to create a social space where strangers could come and sit down and meet one another. Any city has places like that. That's what public spaces are for, oftentimes. And when I've gone to new cities for any length of time, I end up, you know, going to public places like that. So I feel I belong to this world of strangers. You know, there's this place where I can meet, I can encounter other human beings, and I don't feel like an outsider or on some kind of footing together. And that's what we were trying to create. So, well, the philosophy we've got out of it is, and this applies to the world, you have one value, and that's that you got to make money from the coffee, to sales. And you have another value, community. And is it possible for the two to overlap in such a way where both ends are served, but neither subordinates the other merely to its purpose? For instance, if we just continued to give away the coffee to friends, et cetera, we couldn't. We would have failed because we couldn't have afforded to do it. However, if we just sold the coffee to make money off a captive market, then that would kill the community spirit, which is the whole reason for it. I'm glad we don't just increase the ticket price so we can afford to do that, because it makes people think. If they think that the only meaningful exchange of value is to flash cash at the counter when they buy the product, they should think again and follow people after they bought that cup of coffee and sit down in a public space that's designed to get people to interact with one another and to get strangers to interact with one another, and they'll see value of another kind flourishing. So that then you begin to think, well, you know, perhaps there are lessons we've learned in our little experiment could be in some ways exported into the world and live side by side with the elements of a commercial society.
So that leads to another question I have. Could our society exist without money, a strictly a gift economy, or is that coffee shop a lesson that
you wouldn't want to live in a gift economy, and you wouldn't, and nobody, for all the talk, would be tremendously happy with a barter economy. The great thing about a market system and money is that it makes it possible to acquire things without having a relationship with someone else. If you had to have a relationship to meet all your manifold needs in the world we live in, well, you couldn't. You wouldn't have the time. You know, our liberty is well served by markets. It's only when markets begin to substitute for society itself that the deal goes sour. And in society at large, if there were activities that involve people for some transcendent purpose, some communal purpose that involved gifting on some scale, I don't see that as a substitute for the market, but I do see it, I think it would go a long ways toward reconditioning how we consume. That's going on in this country right now. And even the gifting, you're talking about what's of most essential value to human beings, then that would surely condition the pattern of consumption of people in the marketplace. They would then ask themselves, as they are asking themselves now in a time of economic struggle, do I really need this? Does it actually serve what I value in life? You have to begin making choices. Clearly, the way we live is unsustainable. We have to find a way of being happy and being satisfied and being connected to one another while not consuming so much. There's not world enough. We're running through it. And in all the economic discourse I hear, no one seems to question much the sustainability of spread eagle consumption economy, except we know that the Chinese, if they all have two car garages, we're all in trouble. There are too many. But yet how can we say to the developing world, you shouldn't consume so much when we're the world's hogs? Well, that's a spiritual dilemma, and unless we can solve that, then I think we have a very, very practical problem in front of us. How is it possible then to live well and be happy and not consume at near the levels that we do? I think that the operation, the dynamics of a gift economy are at least a part of the answer to that. It would be very naive. It would be saying, let's do away with the money and do away. But that's like saying, let's be tribal. You know, and usually that just means putting on headphones, taking some substance and getting groovy. And I was around. I'm old enough to have been a hippie, or at least I passed for a hippie. And I know just how callow that is. No, you wouldn't want to be a tribal person. No one in America much would. They'd be like euthanasia. They'd lose their individual identity. They're not up for it. And tribal people would like a little more liberty. Maybe it's somewhere in between you could find a happy mean. All I know is that the developer world preaching to the undeveloped world about how we've got to right now they're having an environmental summit, and the developing world will say, well, you have to cut down using charcoal. Good God, what bad form. No wonder that the have-not nations are irate and enraged by that. You know, we could learn from them. You know, those very societies have rich ceremonial cultures, and much of that involves interactions that are like what I've described with the gift economy. We've lost all that. Maybe they have something we need. Certainly we have something that they'd appreciate. They want to take care of their families. They want to survive better. They would like to be lead more individually defined lives. maybe the two sides can get together. In a general way, I think if they don't get together, it doesn't look good for our species. That's
true. All right, I think that's it. I guess the only other thing, I don't know if you've thought of any other things you want to add or remember any other gifts or trinkets that you've gotten over the years or things that you've received.
Well, you know, there's been an evolution in the giving of gifts. When we first started publicly saying, well, it's about gift giving, then a lot of people responded by bringing trinkets, plastic trinkets. What we often call in Black Rock City, moop, matter out of place. Things that get dropped on the ground because they're, you know, well, thank you, but it doesn't mean anything to you. You didn't want it, and you chuck it. And then the community, there was a community discourse in various media, and people began to say, yeah, it's Jim Crack. Those are pseudo-gifts. You know, if you're going to give a gift, give something that means something to you. It didn't just mean something because you went to Chinatown and picked up a bunch of plastic, you know, gewgaws. Try a little harder. Think about it. And here's the real challenge. Think about something that means something to you that could span the distance between you and some stranger who you don't know, so you don't even know what their tastes are, but you know they're a human being. And people started changing. People started giving things that might be useful and that might be, in fact, in that circumstance, really useful. You know, that might just save someone's ass out there. And so they began to do that. And then,
what are some examples?
Well, I'll give you an example, and this is a completely spontaneous. I knew some people who have been coming for years, and their neighbor out there in one of the streets was a guy who was obviously a neophyte and was organizing, somewhat anal, I suspect. He was just really organizing things on the ground in a very ordered fashion, and he was preparing for the arrival of his wife in 2 days. So he was going to make it, you know, just spick and span and perfect for, you know, honey. And it looked like everything he had, he'd got from a, you know, ordered out of an L.L. Bean catalog. And he had pleated shorts, and he was just a shiny novice. It's cute. But then, of course, a wind came up and picked up everything he had displayed on the ground and ordered for assembly and chucked it into oblivion. Because the wind will do that in the desert. It was gone. And the man had a nervous breakdown. And they watched this, and they do what would be natural, and particularly natural there, where everyone feels connected to everyone in many ways and helpful. And you all face the same challenge together. So it's a fellowship. And they went over, and they said, oh, it's not so bad. And he said, yeah, but a tent, and honey's coming, and And they said, come over here, sit down, have some tea. Get out of the heat. Get in the shade here, sit down. And so while they comforted him, they put the word out because they knew a lot of people in the neighborhood. And they talked to him about, well, what'd you lose? What are you lacking? What do you really need? What do you really need? Before the afternoon had passed, they had assembled an entirely new kit for him. Made from what other people in the neighborhood had given. He'd had no connection to anybody until now. That's why he was so agonized. He was alone in this existential crisis. And he ended up, by all accounts, having the time of his life. I don't know if his wife was satisfied, but that's his problem and not mine. So that was a gift. I mean, that was a gift. It felt perfectly natural. No one reflected on it. No one thought about whether they ought to do it. So there are people, you know, I know one of, you know, people carry lip balm around, and when they see somebody whose lips are beginning to crack in the desert, which can be very painful, or they'll bring socks, and someone's feet are you know, not faring well because they've been imprudent enough to walk around in alkaline sediments without their shoes on, they'll give them socks. Then there are other things, you know. There's a lot of, I say, like just creative performance things, you know, where all sorts of touching things, you know, that people do. I was out at the Man one year, and a guy with a rickshaw showed up, who was a Russian who did this magnificent, dolorous, world-weary shtick about, you know, being a laborer and pulling the cart. And actually, it was a joke about gift giving. He was giving us a gift, but he acted as if it wasn't a gift at all. And he had us in stitches, and he took us all the way. It happened just as my girlfriend's heel broke from her shoe, which was pretty fairly disabling. He showed up, one of those serendipitous things, took us back to camp, kept us laughing for 20 minutes, and then disappeared into the night. I don't know what his name was. Oh, I think he gave us a name, but I don't think it was his name. And well, that was a delightful gift. It was a delightful gift. And I gave a gift, probably the favorite gift I've given anyone out there, a good friend I know, whose name will go unrecorded. And he's just a wonderful person, and ebullient, articulate, very verbal. And years before, I found this the trunk of a small tree with this wonderfully gnarled root system, sun-bleached, and it was just striking. And I have an eye for just beautiful artifacts, and I just took it home. I had no use for it, never thought of one. It was just this compelling object. And so I took it to the desert that year, having thought of him. Now, I don't mean to suggest that my friend talks too much. I love him. And I thought, well, you know, I gave it to him, and I hooked it up considerably, but, you know, with anticipation. And well, here it is. This is the staff of what did I call it? The staff of speech, or the staff of truth-telling, the staff of something or other. And like it was something from a Tolkien story. And I said, when you speak, you should hold this. But the rule is that you should think very carefully about what you're going to say before you say it. And he just lit up. He just lit up and carried that around and has been carrying it for years. And he'll hold it, and you can see him thinking, you know, and then he'll speak. And I wasn't really criticizing him. I think he's delightful. But I just, by an intuition, thought it might be something that would be a spiritual resource for him. So that was a gift that was adapted to the person, the uniqueness of the person that it was given to. And he looked good with it. Looked better than I would have.